All right, our next speaker is Frank Frisella from USDA ARS Minnesota, and he's going to discuss keeping it green.
Thanks, Stephanie, and thank you guys for coming, and for the online people, thank you for participating as well. I may start, I'm getting over a cold, a very severe cold, so I may go into a coughing fit, and my voice might crack, so forgive me if that's going to happen. Hopefully it won't. So, Keep It Green, Ecosystem Services of Year-Round Cropping, and or another subtitle is Cleaning Up with Cash Cover Crops. This is a joint presentation. I'll be the only one talking, but it's not just myself. It's Don Wise from the University of Minnesota, Russ Gesch from ARS as well, and several other people also. Now, so joint publication, and this logo that you see here is a logo for the Forever Green Initiative. It took a long time for that logo to be created. The University of Minnesota has lots of rules and regulations about logos. Who knew? But anyway, after a year or two of logo potential logos, that one was finally approved by university administrators. And so you're going to see that on a lot of these slides here. The Forever Green Initiative is mostly from the University of Minnesota and now has its own website, so please visit that website if you get a chance. And when you get onto that website, one of the first things you'll see is a series of pictures of a high boy going through a maturing cornfield. That's Professor Scott Wells. He's not spraying anything. He's actually planting. He's planting pennycress in this case in standing corn. And I'm going to show you the relevance of that in a few minutes from now. Just kind of keep that those pictures of that high boy in mind. Now, the Forever Green Initiative is becoming increasingly popular at the University of Minnesota and elsewhere, and so there's a number of papers and posters at the ASA meeting this week that will be given by grad students, postdocs, and professors that are associated with the Forever Green Initiative. This is just a partial list. The list here is we'll be talking about two particular crops, pennycress, and winter camelina, the two crops that I'm going to be emphasizing in this presentation. But there are several other crops like intermediate wheatgrass and so forth that are people at on the Forever Green Initiative are working. So anyway, it's a large and very active group of researchers now at the University of Minnesota and elsewhere. So, what my topics would be year-round cropping or cash cover crops, and what am I talking about? What's that all about? Well, I'm going to have a long lead-up to this, and so bear with me. This is one of my favorite pictures. It's a chart made by Jonathan Aguilar and published last year, and it shows county-level crop diversity indices across the United States. And we've got this going back several years, but this is the most recent map from the 2012 crop census. And you can see some counties, hopefully you can see the colors from where you're seated, there are some of the counties are colored blue, especially the dark blue. That indicates really high crop diversity. So you see some of the counties in the Central Valley of California. So that really dark county, imagine that there might be 10 to 20 crops growing there, and each one of those crops accounts for, say, 5 to 10% of the cropping acreage in that county. Consequently, it has a very high diversity index. Now, contrast that with the color red, and you can see, for example, in the Corn Belt, two counties that stick out in Iowa and Illinois, they kind of remind me of beady, bloodshot eyes leering at you. So I created this slide. When I started working on this slide, it was around Halloween time, so I was imagining a Halloween mask there with beady eyes. Anyway, those counties are Hamilton County, Iowa, and DuPage County, Illinois. Hamilton County, Iowa, incidentally, is just the county just north of Story County, Iowa, which is where the home of Iowa State University. And that red color indicates continuous corn. Now, there might be other crops growing in those counties as well, but it's basically continuous corn in those counties. If I was a plant breeder, corn breeder at Iowa State University, I'd be patting myself on the back. I'd be congratulating myself. If I was an ecologist, I would be commiserating about that fact. But whatever the case is, it's more or less a monocrop, in this case, of corn. Now, other counties that might have red, like Nye County, Nevada, that's continuous irrigated hay, year after year. So the red color doesn't always mean corn. It can just mean a low, very, very low diversity in crops. Now, that's going to be important in those red counties in the Corn Belt. What do you see? What makes those counties look the color red? Well, one field is corn, the adjacent field is corn. And not only one field and adjacent field, but one year and the next year, it's always the same, corn after corn after corn. Now, in those brown areas of the Corn Belt, in Iowa, southern Minnesota, in Illinois, and so forth, then the other scene that you see is this, soybean, corn-soybean rotation. Now, as a weed scientist, I'm a weed scientist, and as a weed scientist, I can look at that slide and say, damn good job, guys. Not a single weed in that field. If I was an ecologist, I'd be looking at that same slide and saying, what in the world did they apply to that field to take out every single weed? So that could be an issue. But nevertheless, this is part of this presentation is part of the Forever Green Initiative. So if it's green, it's good. Okay. And that slide was taken in July. Now, the next slide is a satellite image, and the green that also from July, and the green that you see there is good. Though it represents those growing crops, sequestering carbon, putting that carbon into the soil and enriching the soil, and so on and so forth. But now, what happens during the remainder of the year? So let's start at the beginning of the growing season in late April, early May, and the same satellite images. And there's a lot of brown in that landscape that represents that tilled ground. Could be even no-till ground, but it's exposed soil. A lot of brown there. Even later on in early May, we still see a lot of brown. That brown color that you see through Minnesota down into Iowa, that's a good representation of the Des Moines lobe of the Wisconsin glaciation, incidentally. But whatever the case is, it's not covered by green. Later on in the spring, late May and into early June, there's still a fair amount of brown, but it's starting to become greener at least. The corn and soybean is starting to fill in the rows a little bit. Not till we get till July is it completely green, and then it stays green throughout August and even into September. By the time we get to October, it starts turning brown again because we're harvesting the crops. That soil is exposed. We might be tilling that soil, depending upon where you are in the Midwest, where tillage can still be very common. And then later on, past October, you know what it looks like. It looks like this. That's a good scene here. It's not snow-covered. If the temperature is high enough so that we're getting some melting, then the snow and ice is melting, that water is forming into rivulets and gullies and running downstream and running typically into the Mississippi River, maybe the Ohio River, maybe the Missouri River, and it's heading down to New Orleans. When it gets down to New Orleans, what does it do? That red spot that you see there is the hypoxic zone. That hypoxic zone you've been hearing about, if you're young, if you're 30 years old or less, you've been hearing about the hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico your entire life. One of the researchers who works on this is Nancy Rabelais, and she's been working on this for decades. But since we've been working on it for decades, it must be improving, right? No. It's getting worse, if anything. So here are the nitrate levels in the Mississippi River water near Baton Rouge, Louisiana. The darker line up on top is the nitrate level during the month of May 2016. The line below it is the nitrate level, average nitrate levels during those same days, but in previous years. So it's getting worse rather than better. And that can be seen by looking at nitrate levels in the water, as well as the size of the hypoxic zone down below New Orleans. So both are increasing over time. So the problem is getting worse, not better. Why is it getting worse, and where is all that nitrate coming from? It's coming from the entire Mississippi River drainage area, but there are some hot spots. So here's a chart that comes from that was just published last week in the Journal of Environmental Quality, one of the Tri-Society journals, so it's got to be true information. And it shows the hot spots. The red dots represent where in stream water, where nitrate levels are exceeding 10 milligrams per liter. That's a critical cutoff point. All of those dots represent elevated nitrate levels, but the critical levels are red. And you can see where they are. There are some in Illinois, lots of them in Iowa, and some in southern Minnesota as well. Exactly the place in that map of the United States showing cropping diversity where we have very low crop diversity. We're also having high nitrate concentrations in river streams and river from those rivers from those areas. From that same publication in Journal of Environmental Quality, the authors plotted the percentage of the watershed that contains corn in 1 year and show that it's related to nitrate concentrations the following year in stream and river waters. Okay, so if you have scenes that look like this, that's the issue. Now, I'm a federal employee. I know who butters my bread, or in this case, I know who puts margarine on my bread. And corn and soybean are big industries. And I'm not trying to change, we're not suggesting we should change those industries. What we're suggesting is we can tweak the system in one way or another that will allow changes in the total system. And whether that total system change is nitrate in water or herbicide resistance or pest resistance in general, both of which I think, all of which are just simply flip sides of the same coin. So, but I'm going to set up some straw men in the next minute or two, and then I'm going to knock those straw men down. So how do we correct this situation? What do we do? If we're not going to plant corn or soybean, what are we going to do? Well, I know. Let's plant alfalfa. It's a perennial crop. We'll never have to till that soil. We're not going to be adding nitrogen fertilizer to that soil. We can solve that problem. And not too many weeds are going to be growing in that alfalfa, at least summer growing weeds. So that's an idea, huh? Or better yet, let's plant conservation reserve. Don't have to worry about anything then. The ecologists will certainly be happy if we do that. Any water draining off those fields is probably so clean of nitrate we could drink it straight out of that tile drainage area. And is there any information to back that up? Well, yeah, there is. So this comes from a retired soil scientist agronomist named Giles Randall, published almost 20 years ago now, where he's showing the tile drainage across years with different amounts of rainfall and so forth, so you get different amounts of tile flow. And then the nitrate loss from fields that had been planted to continuous corn or corn-soybean rotation. And regardless whether it's continuous corn or the soybean or corn phases of the corn-soybean rotation, getting massive amounts of nitrate losses from those fields. But compare that to alfalfa and conservation reserve, there's basically no nitrate loss at all. You could probably drink that water coming off that field. So there's the solution. Just use one of those two, alfalfa or conservation reserve, and you solve the problem, right? And of course, you'd probably solve the problem with resistance, whether pest resistance in general also. But now, that would only work if you own that alfalfa, field, now farm, it would only work well economically if you also owned a dairy, or if you lived next to a dairy so you could sell that alfalfa. And if you planted conservation reserve, that would only work if you're independently wealthy. With conservation reserve program payments, for example, the average payment in North Dakota was only $44 per acre in 2016. You're not going to be sending too many of your kids to college on an income like that. So that's probably not going to work. You probably need something else. You have to change the system in some other way. What other way? Well, here's the one way that we think may contribute to the solution, not only of pest resistance, but also many other ecosystem aspects of agriculture. And that is cash cover crops. So what am I talking about with cash cover crops? I want to talk about two of them. First one is going to be pennycress. The second one is winter camelina. So this is a pennycress that was planted in September after soybean harvest, and the photo was taken the 24th of October. And that's not a bad-looking field of or plot, in this case, of green. That's pretty good cover of pennycress. And we estimate that a cover crop with that size would probably be sequestering about 70 to 75 pounds of nitrogen per acre, 75 kilos per hectare, in both the shoot and root material combined. Now, pennycress, most of you probably know pennycress, yes, field pennycress, the weed, and indeed it is a weed, but there's a breeding program now at the University of Minnesota as well as in the state of Illinois for converting pennycress into a crop plant. It's a member of the mustard family. It's a winter annual. It's extremely cold hardy, so it survives the winter quite nicely. In the springtime, when growth resumes on pennycress, the seeds are produced very rapidly, and those seeds have a high oil content. And because the seeds mature very rapidly, gives it the potential to be used in a double cropping or relay cropping situation with soybean or a number of other crops. The other nice thing about pennycress is that it's a diploid. I don't know much about genetics, but the geneticists, the breeders, claim if a plant is a diploid, has two sets of genes, it's much easier to manipulate than something like winter camelina, which is a hexaploid, six sets of genes. Pennycress in our area yields about 1,500 pounds per acre, 1,500 kilos per hectare, roughly. Has relatively high oil content. For our lines, about 35% oil or so. And that oil, you can't eat it right now, although the breeders are working on some lines that might have edible oil, but right now the oil has a high level of erucic acid, which makes it toxic, so you can't eat it. But it is useful for biodiesel and other industrial purposes. In fact, they have the chemistry is known for how to convert that oil into biodiesel readily. So it looks like a viable crop for the biofuel industry and for other industrial purposes like plastics and so forth. Now, I mentioned double cropping and relay cropping. Here's the context of that. So remember that first one of those first slides I show you with Professor Scotty Wells up in that high boy planting pennycress? Well, he's planting pennycress in corn that looks something like that. So maturing corn. After that pennycress is planted, and the corn is maturing, it looks more like this. So you can see the dead corn leaves with the green pennycress coming up through it. And then in this particular slide, we've magically removed all of that corn residue. And removing the corn residue is actually important in this case. We have to bale the corn residue or harvest the corn as corn silage in order to encourage, at this point, to encourage the growth of pennycress and or winter camelina. Whatever the case, the following spring, the crop looks like this. It starts producing seed heads very quickly in May, and those seed heads mature in June, and we harvest that crop in late June. In the meantime, we can either plant soybean into that growing pennycress crop, or we can wait until we harvest the crop and then plant soybean. But in any case, we get another crop, a typical summer growing crop. Most of the experiments we've used, we've performed, we use soybean. That soybean then will mature later in September as usual, and you can see green in between the rows there, and that's the volunteer pennycress coming up from seed shatter that occurred during pennycress harvest. So it's almost a self-perpetuating system. Now, we haven't perfected the self-perpetuation yet, but some of the students are working on that issue at the moment. Right now, we've been planting the pennycress all the time rather than having it self-perpetuate through seed shattering. Anyway, it's a dual cropping system or a relay cropping system. Now, let's look at some actual plots, research plots, where we grow in pennycress. And in this case, the pennycress was compared to other cover crops, and that is oats that are planted in the fall and radish, like tillage radish that's planted in the fall as well. Now, in this particular case, the oat plots and the radish plots were split so that we also planted pennycress in with the oats, pennycress in with the radish. And you'll see that in the following slide where we show oilseed yields Then we planted soybean after, in the following spring, we planted soybean into those same plots. So here's total oil seed yields. The red bars represent the soybean. The blue bars represent the pennycress seed yield. The first three bars that you see are where no pennycress had been planted. So over here, no pennycress had been planted, but we do have radish cover crop, oat cover crop, both of which die over winter, and then no cover crop at all. And all three of those have about the same yield, 3,000 kilos per hectare, roughly 3,000 pounds per acre, roughly 50 bushels per acre. Compare that now to the to where we had pennycress, and we planted pennycress at either 5.5 or 11 kilos per hectare of seed, which is the same as 5 and 10 pounds per acre of seed. And just focus on two of those bars. This bar with no cover crop other than the pennycress at 5 pounds per acre, and then this bar with no pennycress only, no other cover crop, with the pennycress planted at 10 pounds per acre. In both cases, the yields, the combined yields of pennycress and soybean are significantly greater than those of the monocrop soybean. Okay, so we're getting more seed yield from having two crops. Who knew you could do that? If we add some gross figures, values, to those bars, the monocrop soybean would average about $1,000 per hectare for gross returns. As opposed to those pennycress plus soybean plots, we're getting about $1,300 to $1,400 gross returns. So a $300 to $400 per hectare increase with two crops as opposed to one crop in the same land in the same year. So not too bad. It looks like it's working. How about weeds? So we're supposed to be talking, I'm a weed scientist, supposed to be talking about weeds. Now imagine weeds, especially the summer growing weeds, especially in our areas now where these plots are. The typical weeds are going to be water hemp, glyphosate resistant water hemp. The biomass of those summer weeds is fairly high where we have no pennycress. If it's standard soybean production, conventional soybean production, or even where we have the radish or the oat as a fall cover crop, when they're planted as fall cover crops, they only affect winter weeds, winter annual weeds, certainly not the summer growing weeds. Whoops. And compare those bars then, getting roughly about 100 grams per square meter of weed biomass, of summer growing weed biomass, compared to where we had the pennycress growing, there is virtually no weeds at all. So 95% free weed control. No herbicide involved, just 95% weed suppression simply with the cover crop, in this case, pennycress. And that's not too bad. Why are we getting that sort of weed suppression? This is the pennycress crop plants here. You can see how dark it is underneath. Any small seeded weed like a water hemp is not going to be able to thrive in a situation like that. So good weed control with pennycress cover crops. So that's pennycress. Now let's focus on camelina for a few minutes. Camelina is also a member of the mustard family. It has in case you don't know camelina, it has two common names, neither of which I like. One is false flax, the other one is gold of pleasure. I don't like the idea of false, just sounds, has a negative connotation to it. Then gold of pleasure just sounds too sensual to me. You know, I'm a government employee, I have to take courses about sexual harassment and so forth. So anything that sounds sensual, I try to avoid as best I can. So I'm just going to stick with camelina rather than those two other names. The seeds have a very high oil content, about 35 to 40% seed oil, and a lot of that oil is alpha-linolenic acid. That's one of those heart-healthy oils. It has three, in a chain of 18 carbons, it has three double bonds, makes it a really heart-healthy oil. And so it's an edible oil. It's good to eat. Now, one of the problems with oils that have a high level of linolenic acid is they become rancid very quickly. So you can't, like flax oil, you can't keep it on your kitchen shelf very long. It smells. but not camelina oil, despite its high linoleic acid content. And that's because it has a lot of tocopherol in the seeds as well. And tocopherol, another name for that is vitamin E. It's an antioxidant that protects that oil from oxidizing. And it does. It really does. My wife and I have this bottles of this stuff on our kitchen shelf. We've been using them for a long time. We use it every day now for salad dressing, and it does not become rancid. It works really well. Now, so it does have, the oil has a long shelf life, but the plant itself has a very short life cycle, and that makes it amenable to this double cropping or relay cropping situation again. Now, camelina also has winter types as well as spring types. We're only emphasizing the winter types in most of our research. We also do some work on spring types too, but in most of the stuff I'll be talking about now, it's the winter types that we're emphasizing. This, and I'll tell you why in a moment. Demonstrate that oil is edible, it is being marketed, especially in Europe, but if you go onto the internet right now, you can find camelina oil. You can't go to too many supermarkets and find it, but you go onto the internet and you can find camelina oil, it's quite a nice cooking oil. It's also becoming camelina. Those are pods of camelina with seeds inside those pods. It's also becoming the darling of the food scientists and the biotechnologists. There's a recent issue of Science magazine that was featuring camelina. Camelina oil can also be used in jet fuel. I don't think that's a wise choice. I think you make far more money by selling it as a high-priced cooking oil. But whatever the case is, it can be used in jet fuel. And other biofuels as well. And there's also some other interesting ecosystem services that camelina provide, and I'm going to get into those in just a few minutes. One of the best things, however, about camelina, winter camelina, is its overwinter survival. Virtually 100% of the plants survive. Even if you plant those the seeds very late in the season, like October, and they just start germinating, by the time the deep freeze sets in Minnesota, the deep freeze sets in November. And so by that time, they might only be cotyledons. They still survive the winter. They're truly amazing little plants that can survive cold winter conditions, even without a snow cover. The seed yields of the winter types are about over 1,000 pounds per acre, typically, as opposed to the spring types that typically have a seed yield of over 2,000 pounds per acre. But that's still... And so the spring types are appropriate for, say, western North Dakota, eastern Montana, and adjacent Canada, where they have very, very low precipitation. They can make a buck off the plant there. 2,000 pounds per acre for a spring variety is not economically feasible in the Corn Belt, because the price of corn and soybean outcompeted so readily. However, the winter types are not competing with the corn and soybean. We're double cropping when we use the winter type. So even though it has a lower seed yield, it's still an economically viable plant as long as we double crop it in a corn soybean rotation. Now the University of Minnesota does have a new breeding program for winter camelina, and so that's coming along. Hopefully it's going to come along very nicely and very quickly, but it's in its incipient stages at the moment. So, getting back to weeds for a moment, since I'm a weed guy, here's the weed emergence of summer annual weeds in traditional summer crops. The top blue line that you see out there, the summer crops would be corn and soybean, and adjacent plots of winter camelina. And in this case, we have some winter canola too. Every once in a while, winter canola survives the winter for us. Usually, it doesn't. But anyway, both winter camelina, winter canola, there's hardly any weeds, very little weed emergence of summer annual weeds as opposed to our traditional summer crops. Again, getting greater than 90% weed suppression just by having the winter camelina in the ground. Here's some data from Cody Herning, a grad student at the University of Minnesota. He conducted these experiments at the Rosemount Experiment Station in eastern Minnesota and the Lamberton Experiment Station in southwestern Minnesota. Very different climates, very different conditions, but the results for the biomass of summer-growing weeds in soybean following either camelina or pennycress or the typical winter fallow are virtually identical across those two sites. So in the traditional system, represented by the green bars, that's normal soybean plots, lots of weeds. Wherever we had the soybean followed camelina or pennycress weeds, very, very little weed biomass. We calculate weed control based on those biomasses. In the pennycress, we're getting 98 to 100% control, basically. In the camelina, getting 76 to 85% weed control. Not as good as the pennycress, but still not too bad, considering it's free weed control. And again, imagine those weeds being something like glyphosate-resistant water hemp. That makes it even more impressive. Okay, camelina can also be used in these double crop and relay cropping systems. I'm not going to go through this slide very much, just to show you here. Here's a mature camelina with soybean coming in underneath it in a relay cropping system. We are harvesting the camelina, opening up the canopy, and that soybean then will continue to grow and mature in September at the usual time, and we'll harvest it then. Okay, let's look at yields from those same plots that you just saw there. And the red bar is the soybean yield, and the black bars are the camelina yields. Here's the monocrop soybean, the traditional conventional monocrop soybean right here, getting about 55 bushels per acre in this situation. That's about 3,500 kilos per hectare. And then compare that to the relay cropped soybean following camelina, about 41 bushels per acre for the soybean. And right here, that's the camelina yield, roughly 1,200 pounds of winter camelina seed. Now add that 1,200 pounds here up on top of the soybean, and you get, maybe you can see it, maybe you can't, but there's a little green mark right there. That would be the total yield, the combined yield of both of those crops. And that's higher than the monocrop soybean. So we're making more yield, making more seed by having two crops instead of one. Now let's just look at the oil yield from those same plots. So here's the monocrop soybean. There we go. Monocrop soybean here, about 98 gallons per acre of oil. And compare that to the relay crops soybean following winter camelina, about 130 gallons of oil per acre. Make some crude estimates economic estimates here at about using about $2.50, the value of oil being about $2.50 per gallon, about $300 per acre for the relay cropping system, as opposed to about $250 per acre for the monocrop soybean. Again, making more money with two crops than one. This is the last slide that's going to emphasize economics. And this is just from another experiment and just the drive at home that you really can make more money with dual crops than a single crop, even in a really cold place like Minnesota that has a short growing season. So here's the gross return of winter camelina, the gross return of soybean following winter camelina. You add those two together, you get up here. This is monocrop soybean here. The difference is about $300 per hectare, $125 per acre. Okay, no question about it, you're making more money with the dual crop. But you might question, and legitimately so, if you have two crops instead of one, you're also using more soil water. If you're on a sandy soil or if you're in a more arid area, that could be a concern. So Russ Gesch and my colleague also looked at water use, season-long water use of these systems in two different years, 2010, 2011. And if you look at the difference between the relay crop soybean and the monocrop soybean, there are significant differences in water use, no question about it. However, that difference is only about an inch worth of water in 1 year, maybe 2 inches of water in the second year. So not a huge difference. And where that extra water is being used is in springtime by the camelina. And in springtime, at least in our area, we typically have saturated soils anyway. We want to get rid of some of that extra water. And the camelina is doing that for us. So we don't think it's going to be a huge problem. But again, if you live on if your farm is on a sandy soil, if you're living in an arid area like western North Dakota, it could be an issue. Now, speaking of water, you know, this is we come from Minnesota, so water is a really important issue for recreation and so forth, not just for drinking. What are some of the characteristics of water in our state? Well, for crop use, crop water use, like corn, the black dots that you see here, connected by a black line, that's water use by corn in a typical situation in Minnesota. Most of the water that's being used is occurring in July and August when the corn is at its maximum stage of growth. Precipitation is in the yellowish-green bars that you see here, and of course you get a lot more precipitation that we're getting than what is being used by the corn. And that excess water, at least at certain times of the year, then is running off in fields that are tiled. At least it's running off as tile drainage. And what I want you to see here, the red bars is showing tile drainage. The main point time frame for tile drainage is April, May, and June. That's when most of the tile drainage is occurring. So the next question is, what's in that tile drainage water? To answer that question, actually it was known before we ever started working on this, but we're just to play along with me here. To answer that question, instituted some experiments where we had suction cup lysimeters buried at various depths. We had the runoff troughs where we're measuring water runoff as well as sediment runoff. And then we, over the top of those instruments, we planted camelina, pennycress, soybean, as well as a few other things that I'll show you in the next slide. Here are the treatments that we had here. Monocrop soybean, you know, either a till situation or a no-till situation, or radish, that tillage radish, which winter kills, winter rye that we have to kill in the spring with Roundup, or pennycress and camelina. And in this particular slide, what we're trying to show is nitrate in the leachate water in those plots. And we're averaging the nitrate levels from April through June. Those are those months of high tile drainage, high levels of percolation through the soil profile. And what you can see is pennycress and camelina scrub that water of nitrate. There's very little nitrate in that water compared to our typical monocrop soybean, regardless of whether it's tilled or a no-till situation. It's got a lot of nitrate. So we're cleaning up the water by having those cover crops. That's in the leachate. Now let's take a look at overland flow in terms of total amount of water running off those plots if they were on gentle hill slopes. In the tilled or no-tilled monocrop soybean, we're getting lots of runoff, just as you might expect, whereas with these winter cover crops, cash cover crops like pennycress and camelina, very little runoff. Most of that water is going through the soil, not over the soil. Now, what about the nutrients that might be in that runoff water? So here's nitrate as well as phosphorus in those the water that's running off those soils, those plots. The pennycress and camelina have very low amounts of nitrate in that water compared to the till or no-till monocrop soybean, and also much less phosphorus in that water compared to the till or no-till monocrop soybean. No question about what's happening here. These crops are solving an environmental problem. It's the ecosystem benefit by having those crops on the landscape. Okay, the last little section that I'm going to, you've heard about the pollinator crisis. I'm going to bore you even more with the pollinator crisis and try to show you how these crops can help out in this situation as well. So bees, pollinators in general, big problem, right? Here, this lady that you see on the right, Marla Spivak, she is sort of the queen bee of science for pollinators. MacArthur Foundation fellow and so forth. So what she says is that food, not food for you and me, but food for the pollinators, is one of the most critical issues facing pollinators. If they have better food supplies, they again have better immune systems, and they're able to ward off insecticides and all of the mites and various other things that are affecting pollinators. So food's important. We need forage resources for our pollinators. And not only Marla says that, but your own president says it. So here's a report, the Pollinator Research Action Plan, that was produced by the White House last year. And in that report, I just want to call your attention to page 19. I know you can't read it right here, but I'm going to highlight it in the next slide for you. Right there in that action plan, it says this. Your president says this, that you ought to be growing or at least working on crops like camelina and pettycress. There you go. You got a patriotic duty to work on these things. Not that this is going to solve every problem in the world, but if we can use those crops, because they flower so early in the spring, if we can use those crops to help feed our pollinators that are in crisis at the moment, then agriculture gets to be the good guy, not the bad guy. And quite frankly, I'm tired of being the bad guy. Being an agronomist, I'm tired of being the bad guy with respect to the pollinator crisis. I want to be the guy with the white hat on and be one of the good guys. Here's a way we can do it. And we got to do it quickly because this problem is getting worse by every year. So here's a publication that just came out relatively recently from the University of Vermont, where they did some computer modeling showing that these counties, this is Fargo, North Dakota here, this is where I live, Morris, Minnesota, right there, that those counties are the counties that where this particular bumblebee, the rusty patch bumblebee, is most susceptible to extinction. Something's happening in those counties, agriculturally speaking, that is diminishing the populations of those insects. If we can start supplying those insects with more food, maybe we can become the good guys, not the bad guys. Our state of Minnesota, North and adjacent North Dakota, as well as South Dakota and Montana, are the honey bowl of the United States. We produce more honeybees, more honey than any other region in the U.S. So it's big business for us. When our beekeepers start bringing back their bees from the West Coast and the Gulf Coast in April and May, there's nothing for those bees to eat. Nothing. There might be a few dandelions around, but that's going to be it. Maybe a few willows, but not much else. And so what we need are plants on the landscape that are flowering at that time. And agriculture can help do that. Now, this is not a scene from Minnesota. Or North Dakota. It is canola, winter canola, but it's not from us. It's from farther south. But what we can do, so we can't do this. Winter canola doesn't survive for us. But winter camelina and pennycress do, and they flower at the same time. Late April, early May, when those bees are starting to come back from the West Coast. We can use those crops to feed those bees. And we know that the bees, as well as other insects, will go to those crops. We've monitored insect visitation. And if there's a honeybee colony close by, the honeybees will be on those plants, no question about it. But certainly lots of other insects, native insects, will be on those plants too, like native bees, as well as syrphid flies. Now, and incidentally, with syrphid flies, these guys here with those yellow and black stripes, they're also biocontrol agents for soybean aphid. Those insects, the females, will lay eggs, whether on camelina, pennycress, or the soybean that's growing underneath those crops. Those eggs then will hatch into voracious larvae that feed on soybean aphid, potential biocontrol agent. Now, we know that corn and soybean can also be used as forage resources for bees and other pollinating insects, but they're really pathetic. They're not really good resources. Yet they are the main crops that are being grown in our region. The other crops that we have, at least in Minnesota, like forages, like alfalfa, can be very useful resources for pollinators. But what's the management plan for alfalfa? As soon as you see a flower, cut it for hay, right? So they're useless as forage resources for our pollinating insects. And the other crops that might be useful are grown to such a limited extent that they have very little value no matter what. So we have looked at the forage resource value of these winter cover crops like pennycress and winter camelina compared to lots of other oilseed crops like sunflower, canola, and so forth. And what we see is that they're reasonable. They're quite reasonable plants in terms of the amount of nectar sugar that they're producing, the total amount of pollen, and then the crude protein in their pollen that they're producing, that we can actually feed a fair number of honeybee colonies or native pollinators with those resources. And I'm running out of time, so I'm just not going to go through these, and I'm not going to emphasize those slides. But end with this, that when those bees start coming back, from the West Coast and Gulf Coast, and we have things like pennycress and camelina on the landscape, we can feed more of those bees, we can make more honey, and hopefully it's a win-win situation for everyone when we do that. Okay, now the relevance of all of that to resistance in this symposium. I want to emphasize that resistance is an agroecosystem issue. It's not just a herbicide and a pest, not just a pesticide and a pest. There's an ecosystem context to all of this. Resistance is enabled by low diversity. Ecologists talk about alpha, beta, and gamma diversity. Alpha diversity being the diversity within a small area like a field. Gamma diversity being the diversity across an entire region. And beta diversity is the trajectory to go from that small field to that larger region. All of those come into play with resistance. When we have low diversity, we tend to get resistance development. We have higher diversity, it tends to be inhibited. Both crop and management diversity come into play here. But diversity, so it's easy for me to say that, but to increase cropping diversity and management diversity out there on the landscape, we got to make it economically feasible for our growers. They're not going to adopt it otherwise. These cash cover crops, we think, are part of the solution for increasing diversity and making that diversity economically feasible for our growers. And if they do that, we'll also have these other ecosystem benefits like soil protection, nutrient retention, water quality, pollinator health, and maybe, who knows, even biocontrol. That's it. Thank you. Camelina and pennycress are harvested at about the same time, typically the last week of June. Yeah. That's a very good question. Now, in our region, we have so few winter crops that we have very few winter weeds. The winter weeds are present, but they're just not big problems because they don't have any crops to plague, basically. Now, once we start growing winter crops, those winter weeds could become an issue. Very, very good point, good insight there. And we do have, for example, some of the annual bromes, Bromus japonicus, Bromus tectorum, and so forth, are in our area. They're not known to be bad weeds for us, but they're there, and they will become more prominent. There are a number of other weed species, too, that could be issues. So that's something we have to be mindful of. Now, I'm hoping that because we are mixing these winter crops and summer crops, that we can help. There'll be that will help control all of those species. But there's no magic bullet, so these things could become problems for us, no question about it. Not yet, but they could be. Anything else? Yeah, some of the grad students have been working on that. A fellow named Kevin Anderson, and in Cody might even be doing that as well. Cody's sitting right over here, incidentally. So they have been working on that. Now, specifically for weed pressure, I'm not sure we have the data for that particular system that you're talking about, but we are working on that issue. Yeah. Anything else? Yes. Aren't you only allowed one question? Yeah, excellent question. And you need a whole supply chain. So yes, we have had interest from farmers. Some farmers have tried planting some of these crops, but I can't say right now that there's a lot of them doing this. But where there's increasing interest, and what I mentioned supply chain a moment ago, you need the whole supply chain to get this thing to work. So thankfully, for us, that companies like General Mills and PepsiCo are getting interested. And just recently, Purdue Agribusiness, the big chicken people out on the East Coast, they are getting interested in these types of crops and these systems. Once we gave, I think, 300 pounds of camelina seed to General Mills. They have their own food science department that are working on this, and then they've contracted with the University of Minnesota to work on the press cake. After you expel the oil, what the press cake, characteristics of the press cake, not just for animal feed, which is what you normally use press cake for, but for human consumption. PepsiCo is interested in these oils for a couple of different reasons. One might be for make better Doritos, but the other one is they want to use the oil from, say, Pennycress to make packaging material. That bag that the Doritos comes in, they want to make that biodegradable. And so they're thinking about using Pennycress oil to make those types of plastics. Once those sorts of things happen and become established, then the contracts with farmers, in the potential for contracting with farmers increases dramatically. Anything else?
So, what do you do to counteract the increased number of times that people
have to work out? Yeah. I call that the hassle factor. Will farmers adopt something if they have to do more work? Now, most of the equipment, all of the equipment that is necessary to plant, harvest, and manage these crops is more or less identical to what these growers already have. So that probably, they may have to make small modifications, adjusting the screens and sieves and so forth, and combines and whatnot. Taping holes in their grain carts and trucks and so forth, because of the very small size of the seeds. So there are a number of issues like that. But the main one is just in April, when we're asking them to drill this, or early May, when they're asking them to drill the soybean into the camelina. They have a lot of other things going on then. Do they really want to mess around with trying to do that? Harvesting in late June, when they have herbicides that they want to spray on other fields, do they really want to be planting, harvesting camelina and pennycress? I call it the hassle factor. Are they willing to deal with those sorts of things? Most of them probably not. But some of them, the more progressive ones, probably so. The other thing along those lines is that they may not have a choice. For example, in the state of Minnesota, our governor and possibly the state legislature, there's a conflict between the two, but they are the governor and some of the legislators are trying to pass legislation that will force farmers to plant buffer strips along any water body. Whether it's a small water body or a larger one, they have to plant possibly up to a 200-foot wide buffer strip. Many growers, as you might have guessed, don't want to do that. But they're facing reality that they might have to do it to some extent. Maybe not be 200 feet wide, but might be narrower than that, but they may have to do it eventually. So we had a meeting just last year at about the same time with the Minnesota, and the meeting was requested by the Minnesota Corn Council and the Minnesota Soybean and Research, Minnesota Soybean Research and Promotion Council, and to talk about these issues, because they recognize that they may be, their hands may be forced, and they want something that could be economically beneficial for them rather than just a grassy strip of land where they're not going to make any money. Best answer I can give. Anything else?
Thank you, Frank.